The Master Plan. Even as members of Al-Qaeda watched in exultation while the Twin Towers fell and the Pentagon burned on September 11, 2001, they realized that the pendulum of catastrophe was swinging in their direction. Osama bin Laden later boasted that he was the only one in the group's upper hierarchy who had anticipated the magnitude of the wound that Al-Qaeda inflicted on America. But he also admitted that he was surprised by the tower's collapse. His goal had been to goad America into invading Afghanistan, an ambition that had caused him to continually raise the stakes. The simultaneous bombings of the U.S. embassies in Kenya and Tanzania in August 1998, followed by the attack on the American warship, the USS Cole, in the harbor of Aden, Yemen, in October 2000. Neither of those actions had led the United States to send troops to Afghanistan. After the attacks on New York and Washington, however, it was clear that there would be an overwhelming response. Al-Qaeda members began sending their families home and preparing for war. 2 months later, the Taliban government in Afghanistan, which had given sanctuary to bin Laden, was routed, and the Al-Qaeda fighters in Tora Bora were pummeled. Although bin Laden and his chief lieutenants escaped death or capture, nearly 80% of Al-Qaeda's members in Afghanistan were killed. Moreover, Al-Qaeda's cause was repudiated throughout the world. Even in Muslim countries, where the indiscriminate murder of civilians and the use of suicide operatives were denounced as being contrary to Islam. The remnants of the organization scattered. Al-Qaeda was essentially dead. From hiding places in Iran, Yemen, Iraq, and the tribal areas of western Pakistan, Al-Qaeda's survivors lamented their failed strategy. Abu al-Walid al-Masri, a senior leader of Al-Qaeda's inner council, later wrote that Al-Qaeda's experience in Afghanistan was a tragic example of an Islamic movement managed in an alarmingly meaningless way. He went on. Everyone knew that their leader was leading them to the abyss and even leading the entire country to utter destruction, but they continued to carry out his orders faithfully and with bitterness. In June 2002, bin Laden's son, Hamza, posted a message on an Al-Qaeda website. "O Father, where is the escape, and when will we have a home? O Father, I see spheres of danger everywhere I look. Tell me, Father, something useful about what I see." "O son," bin Laden replied, "suffice to say that I am full of grief and sighs. I can only see a very steep path ahead. A decade has gone by in vagrancy and travel, and here we are in our tragedy. Security has gone, but danger remains." In the view of Abu Musab al-Suri, a Syrian who had been a member of Al-Qaeda's inner council and who was a theorist of jihad, the greatest loss was not the destruction of the terrorist organization, but the downfall of the Taliban, which meant that Al-Qaeda no longer had a place to train, organize, and recruit. The expulsion from Afghanistan, Suri later wrote, was followed by 3 meager years, which we spent as fugitives, dodging the international dragnet by moving between safe houses and hideouts. In 2002, Suri fled to eastern Iran, where bin Laden's son Saad and Al-Qaeda's security chief Saif al-Adl had also taken refuge. There was a $5 million bounty on his head. In this moment of exile and defeat, he began to conceive the future of jihad. Abu Musab al-Suri was born into a middle-class family in Aleppo, Syria, in 1958, the year of bin Laden's birth. His real name is Mustafa Setmariam Nasser. He became involved in politics at the University of Aleppo, where he studied engineering. Later he moved to Jordan, where he joined the Muslim Brotherhood. In 1982, when Assad decided that the Brotherhood posed a threat to his authority, his troops slaughtered as many as 30,000 people in the city of Hama, one of the group's strongholds. The ruthlessness of Assad's response shocked Suri. He renounced the Brotherhood, which he held responsible for provoking the destruction of Hama, and took refuge in Europe for several years. In 1985, he moved to Spain, where he married and became a Spanish citizen. 2 years later, he found his way to Afghanistan, where he met Osama bin Laden. The two men had a contentious relationship. Although Suri became a member of al-Qaeda's inner council, he grew disillusioned by the fecklessness and the disorganization that characterized al-Qaeda's training camps in Afghanistan. "People come to us with empty heads and leave us with empty heads," he complained. "They have done nothing for Islam. This is because they have not received any ideological or doctrinal training." In 1992, Suri moved back to Spain, where he helped to establish a terrorist cell that played a part in the planning of September 11th. 2 years later, he went to England. Red-haired and sturdily built, with a black belt in judo and a reputation for curmudgeonly commentary, he soon became a fixture in the Islamist press in London. He wrote articles for the magazine Al-Ansar, which promoted the insurgency in Algeria, that resulted in more than 100,000 deaths. The magazine's editor was Abu Qatada, a Palestinian cleric who was often characterized as al-Qaeda's spiritual guide in Europe. Al-Ansar was in many ways the first jihadi think tank. Suri and other strategists suggested tactics for undermining the despotic regimes in the Arab world, and they promoted attacks on the West. American and European intelligence agencies were still blind to the threat that the Islamist movement posed. Jamal Khashoggi, a prominent Saudi journalist, met Qatada and Suri in the early 90s. They struck him as far more radical than Osama bin Laden. At the time, al-Qaeda was primarily an anti-communist organization. "Osama was in the moderate camp," Khashoggi told me. He coined the phrase Salafi jihadis to describe men such as Abu Qatada and Suri, who had been influenced by Salafism, the puritanical fundamentalist strain of Islam, which stressed the notion of continual warfare against unbelievers. "Osama was flirting with these ideas," Khashoggi said. "He was not the one who originated the radical thinking that came to characterize al-Qaeda. He joined these men rather than the other way around. His organization became the vehicle for their thinking." Suri later wrote about bin Laden's conversion to his ideas, which took place after bin Laden returned to Afghanistan from Sudan in 1996. Bin Laden was already angry at his own country for letting American and coalition troops defend the kingdom against Saddam Hussein's million-man army, rather than relying on bin Laden's own small corps of Arab-Afghan veterans. He also held the Americans responsible for having his Sudanese hosts summarily expel him from the country, stealing everything he owned. So he was a willing listener when the Salafi jihadists presented him with their analysis. They pointed first to the continuing presence of American troops on the holy soil of the Arabian Peninsula. The corrupt Islamic scholars lent their authority to the royal family, which in turn sanctioned the presence of the coalition forces. There were two possible solutions. Either attack the royal family, which might infuriate the Saudi people, or strike at the American presence. Bin Laden chose the second option, Suri recalled. Suri believed that the jihadi movement had nearly been extinguished by the drying up of financial resources, the killing or capture of many terrorist leaders, the loss of safe havens, and the increasingly international cooperation among police agencies. Accordingly, he saw the Taliban's takeover of Afghanistan in 1996 as a golden opportunity, and he went there the following year. He set up a military camp in Afghanistan and experimented with chemical weapons. He also arranged bin Laden's first television interview with CNN. The journalist Peter Bergen, who spent several days in Suri's company while producing the segment, recalled, "He was tough and really smart. He seemed like a real intellectual, very conversant with history, and he had an intense seriousness of purpose. He certainly impressed me more than bin Laden." In 1999, Suri sent bin Laden an email message accusing him of endangering the Taliban regime with his highly theatrical attacks on American targets and mocking his love of publicity. "I think our brother has caught the disease of screens, flashes, fans, and applause." In his writings, Suri rarely mentions Al-Qaeda and disavows any direct connection to it, despite having served on its inner council. He prefers to speak more broadly of jihad, which he sees as a social movement, encompassing all who bear weapons, individuals, groups, and organizations, and wage jihad on the enemies of Islam. By 2000, he had begun predicting the end of Al-Qaeda, whose preeminence he portrayed as merely a stage in the development of the worldwide Islamist uprising. "Al-Qaeda is not an organization. It is not a group, nor do we want it to be," he wrote. "It is a call, a reference, a methodology. Eventually, its leadership would be eliminated. So in the time that remained, Al-Qaeda's main goal should be to stimulate other groups around the world to join the jihadi movement." Suri's mission was to codify the doctrines that animated Islamist jihad, so that Muslim youths of the future could discover the cause and begin their own spontaneous religious war. In 2002, Suri, in his hideout in Iran, began writing his defining work, Call for Worldwide Islamic Resistance, which is 1,600 pages long and was published on the internet in December 2004. Didactic and repetitive, but also ruthlessly candid, the book dissects the faults of the jihadi movement and lays out a plan for the future of the struggle. "The goal," he writes, "is to bring about the largest number of human and material casualties possible for America and its allies." He specifically targets Jews, Westerners in general, the members of the NATO alliance, Russia, China, atheists, pagans, and hypocrites, as well as any type of external enemy. At the same time, he perversely blames Al-Qaeda for dragging the entire jihadi movement into an unequal battle that it is likely to lose. In Suri's view, the underground terrorist movement, that is Al-Qaeda and its sleeper cells, is defunct. This approach was a failure on all fronts because of its inability to achieve military victory or to rally the Muslim people to its cause. He proposes that the next stage of jihad will be characterized by terrorism created by individuals or small autonomous groups, what he terms leaderless resistance, which will wear down the enemy and prepare the ground for the far more ambitious aim of waging war on open fronts, an outright struggle for territory. He explains, "Without confrontation in the field and seizing control of the land, we cannot establish a state, which is the strategic goal of the resistance." His ideas would lay the intellectual groundwork for the rise of ISIS. There are five regions, according to Suri, where the jihadis should focus their energies: Afghanistan, Central Asia, Yemen, Morocco, and especially Iraq. The American occupation of Iraq, he declares, inaugurated a historical new period that almost single-handedly rescued the jihadi movement just when many of its critics thought it was finished. Suri was captured in Pakistan in November 2005 and is rumored to have been rendered to Syria. However, in 2010, an article with his byline appeared in the online magazine Inspire, a publication of the Al-Qaeda affiliate in Yemen. It's unclear where he is today. The American occupation created a major opportunity for a man named Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, a Bedouin from Jordan. Neither an intellectual nor a strategist, Zarqawi was a convicted criminal who acted largely on brute impulse. But he was also a reckless warrior who gained the respect of the Arab Mujahideen when he arrived in Pakistan in the early 90s. His spiritual guide was a Palestinian sheikh named Abu Muhammad al-Maqdisi, who transformed him from a foot soldier in jihad to a leader who rivaled bin Laden. Maqdisi and Zarqawi formed an immediate bond, an alliance of the man of thought and the man of action. They spent 5 years in prison together in Jordan. But in March 1999, Jordan's new king, Abdullah II, granted amnesty to political prisoners. Zarqawi went to Afghanistan, while his defiant mentor chose to stay in Jordan, where he felt that he was doing productive work. However, he was soon back in prison. Unruly and independent, Zarqawi refused to swear fidelity to bin Laden, instead establishing his own camp in western Afghanistan, populated mainly by Jordanians, Syrians, and Palestinians. He was bluntly critical of al-Qaeda's decision to wage war against America and the West, rather than against corrupt Arab dictatorships. After September 11th, Zarqawi and his followers were flushed out of Afghanistan by the invasion of the coalition forces. He took refuge in Iran, and eventually in the Kurdish region of Iraq. In April 2003, after the U.S. invasion of Iraq, Zarqawi set up a new terror group, Al-Tawhid wal-Jihad, monotheism and jihad. Unlike the senior members of Al-Qaeda, Zarqawi was obsessed with fighting the Shiites, the most evil of mankind, thinking that he would unite the much larger Sunni world into a definitive conquest of what he saw as the great Islamic heresy. That August, shortly after he began his Iraq campaign, he bombed a Shiite mosque, killing 125 Muslim worshippers, including the most popular Shiite politician in the country, Ayatollah Muhammad Bakr al-Hakim, who, had he lived, would probably have become Iraq's first freely elected president. Zarqawi also blew up the UN headquarters in the Canal Hotel in Baghdad, effectively driving the international aid community out of the country. Among the murdered was Sergio Vieira de Mello, one of the most able and charismatic leaders the UN has ever produced. These deaths, so significant in themselves, were characteristic of Zarqawi's war on the very people who could make Iraq into a functioning society: the teachers, the doctors, the courageous political thinkers. In a letter to bin Laden in January 2004, which was intercepted by U.S. intelligence, Zarqawi explained that, "If we succeed in dragging the Shia into the arena of sectarian war, it will become possible to awaken the inattentive Sunnis as they feel imminent danger." He said that he would formally pledge allegiance to al-Qaeda if bin Laden endorsed his battle against the Shiites. In his weakened position, bin Laden agreed, telling Zarqawi to go ahead and use the Shiite card, perhaps because his son Saad and other al-Qaeda figures were being held in Iran, and he vainly hoped that Zarqawi would pressure the Iranians to hand them over. Zarqawi grabbed the wheel of al-Qaeda at a time when its founders were immobilized, reduced to making the occasional pleading videotape designed to sway the unseen jihadi masses. Zarqawi's ability to act, not just talk, was an affront to the secluded leaders who were unable to influence the bloody flow of events in Iraq, the terrorist Super Bowl. Deprived of the managerial oversight of bin Laden, an economics major and international businessman, al-Qaeda began to shape itself around Zarqawi's organizational experience, which is to say that it turned into a gang. It was a model easily replicated by would-be jihadis everywhere. Zarqawi's operatives spread into Europe, where they forged documents and gathered recruits for Iraq. One of his lieutenants in Spain, Amer Azizi, assisted the 9/11 hijackers in Spain and participated in the March 11, 2004 train bombings in Madrid. Zarqawi and his men were putting into action the vision that Abu Musab al-Suri had laid out for them. Small, spontaneous groups carrying out individual acts of terror in Europe while waging an open struggle for territory in Iraq. Suicide bombings became a trademark of Zarqawi's operation, despite Abu Muhammad al-Maqdisi's condemnation of the practice. Zarqawi soon improvised a more gruesome signature. In May 2004, he was filmed decapitating Nicholas Berg, a young American contractor. The footage was posted on the internet. Other beheadings followed, along with bombings and assassinations, hundreds of them. Within radical Islamist circles, Zarqawi's gory executions and attacks on Muslims at prayer became a source of controversy. From prison, Maqdisi chastised his former protege. "The pure hands of jihad fighters must not be stained by shedding inviolable blood," he wrote in July 2004. "There is no point in vengeful acts that terrify people, provoke the entire world against mujahideen, and prompt the world to fight them." Maqdisi also advised jihadis not to go to Iraq, because it will be an inferno for them. "This is, by God, the biggest catastrophe." Zarqawi angrily refuted his spiritual mentor's remarks, saying that he took orders only from God. However, he was beginning to realize that his efforts in Iraq were another dead end for jihad. "The space of movement is starting to get smaller," he had written to bin Laden in June. "The grip is starting to be tightened on the holy warriors' necks, and with the spread of soldiers and police, the future is becoming frightening." The headstrong terrorist was begging for help. Finally, bin Laden agreed to let Zarqawi use the al-Qaeda brand as a way of drawing recruits to his cause. In October 2004, Zarqawi announced his new job title, Emir of al-Qaeda in Iraq. Zarqawi launched a murderous campaign unmatched in the history of al-Qaeda. Before he became a member, al-Qaeda had killed some 3,200 people, most of them on 9/11. Zarqawi's forces probably killed twice that number. In July 2005, Ayman al-Zawahiri, al-Qaeda's chief ideologue and second-in-command, attempted to steer the nihilistic Zarqawi closer to the founder's original course. In a letter, he outlined the next steps for the Iraqi jihad. "The first stage, expel the Americans from Iraq. The second stage, establish an Islamic authority or emirate, then develop it and support it until it achieves the level of a caliphate. The third stage, extend the jihad wave to the secular countries neighboring Iraq. The fourth stage, it may coincide with what came before, the clash with Israel, because Israel was established only to challenge any new Islamic entity. It was a clear and prescient agenda. Zawahiri also advised Zarqawi to moderate his attacks on Iraqi Shiites and to stop beheading hostages. "We are in a battle," Zawahiri reminded him, "and more than half of this battle is taking place in the battlefield of the media." Zarqawi did not heed al-Qaeda's requests. As the Iraqi jihad fell into barbarism, al-Qaeda's leaders began advising their followers to go to Sudan or Kashmir, where the chances of victory seemed more promising. Al-Qaeda, meanwhile, was confronting a new problem, which one of its primary thinkers, Abu Bakr Naji, had already anticipated in an internet document titled "The Management of Savagery." Naji's identity is unknown. Other Islamist writers have said that he was Tunisian, but a Saudi newspaper identified him as Jordanian. William McCants, a fellow at the Brookings Institution and author of "The ISIS Apocalypse: The History, Strategy, and Doomsday Vision of the Islamic State," has translated Naji's work. He said that Abu Bakr Naji might be a collective pseudonym for various theorists of jihad. But he added, "Naji's work has appeared in Sawt al-Jihad, the authoritative al-Qaeda internet magazine, meaning that it reflects the prevailing views of the organization." Naji's document, published in the spring of 2004, addresses the crisis and the opportunity posed by the tumult in the Arab world. "During our long journey through victories and defeats, through the blood, severed limbs, and skulls, some of the movements have disappeared and some have remained," he writes. "If we meditate on the factor common to the movements which have remained, we find that there is political action in addition to military action." Understanding the politics of the enemy, Naji suggests, is a necessary evil. "We urge that the leaders work to master political science just as they would work to master military science." Control of the media is especially important in the anarchic period that the jihadi movement has entered. When people are outraged by the carnage, if we succeed in the management of this savagery, that stage, by the permission of God, will be a bridge to the Islamic State which has been awaited since the fall of the caliphate, he proclaims. If we fail, we seek refuge with God from that. It does not mean an end of the matter. Rather, this failure will lead to an increase in savagery. Naji writes in the dry, oddly temperate style that characterizes many al-Qaeda strategy studies. And like all jihadi theorists, he embeds his analysis in the tradition of Ibn Taymiyyah, the 13th century Arab theologian whose ideas undergird the Salafi jihadist tradition. However, Naji is also an attentive reader of Western thinkers. Indeed, the thesis of "The Management of Savagery" is drawn from the observation of the Yale historian Paul Kennedy in his book The Rise and Fall of the Great Powers, published in 1987, which is that imperial overreach leads to the downfall of empires. Naji began writing his study in 1998 when the jihad movement's most promising targets appeared to be Jordan, the countries of North Africa, Nigeria, Saudi Arabia, and Yemen, roughly the same countries that bin Laden later penciled in. Naji recommended that jihadis continually attack the vital economic centers of these countries, such as tourist sites and oil refineries, in order to make the regimes concentrate their forces, leaving their peripheries unprotected. Sensing weakness, Naji predicts, the people will lose confidence in their governments, which will respond with increasingly ineffective and alienating acts of repression. Eventually, the governments will lose control. Savagery will naturally follow, offering Islamists the opportunity to capture the allegiance of a population that is desperate for order. Even though the jihadis will have caused the chaos, that fact will be overlooked as the fighters impose security, provide food and medical treatment, and establish Islamic courts of justice. After coalition forces overran al-Qaeda compounds in Afghanistan in late 2001, they seized thousands of pages of internal memoranda, records of strategy sessions and ethical debates, and military manuals, but not a single page devoted to the politics of al-Qaeda. Naji briefly addresses whether jihadis are prepared to run a state should they succeed in toppling one. He quotes a colleague who posed the question, "Assuming that we get rid of the apostate regimes today, who will take over the Ministry of Agriculture, Trade, Economics, etc.? Beyond the simplistic notion of imposing a caliphate and establishing the rule of Islamic law, the leaders of the organization appear never to have thought about the most basic facts of government. What kind of economic model would they follow? How would they cope with unemployment, so rampant in the Muslim world? Where do they stand on the environment, healthcare?" The truth, as Naji essentially concedes, is that the radical Islamists have no interest in government. They are interested only in jihad. In his book, Naji breezily answers his friend as follows. "It is not a prerequisite that the Mujahid movement has to be prepared, especially for agriculture, trade, and industry. As for the one who manages the techniques in each ministry, he can be a paid employee who has no interest in policy and is not a member of the movement or the party. There are many examples of that, and a proper explanation would take a long time." Fuad Hussein, a radical Jordanian journalist, met Zarqawi and Maqdisi in 1996 when, he writes, "a career of trouble led me to Suwakha prison." He had published a series of articles criticizing the Jordanian government, and in response, the authorities locked him up for a month. Since Zarqawi and Maqdisi were being held at the same jail, Hussein sought out interviews with them. Eventually, Zarqawi served him tea while Maqdisi talked politics. Zarqawi mentioned that he had just been released from solitary confinement after more than 8 months and had lost his toenails as a result of being tortured. The next week, Zarqawi was sent to solitary again, and his followers staged a riot. Hussein became the negotiator between the prisoners and the warden, who relented, an episode that cemented Hussein's standing among the radical Islamists. In 2005, Hussein produced what is perhaps the most definitive outline of al-Qaeda's master plan, a book titled Al-Zarqawi, The Second Generation of al-Qaeda. Although it is largely a flattering biography of Zarqawi and his movement, Hussein also incorporates the insights of other al-Qaeda members, notably Saif al-Adl, the security chief. It is chilling to read this work and realize how some events hewed to al-Qaeda's forecasts. On the basis of interviews with Zarqawi and Adl, Hussein claims that dragging Iran into conflict with the United States was the key to al-Qaeda's strategy. Al-Qaeda, he writes, expects the Americans to go after Iran's principal ally in the region, Syria. The removal of the Assad regime, a long-time goal of jihadis, will allow the country to be infiltrated by Al-Qaeda, putting the terrorists within reach at last of Israel. Al-Qaeda's 20-year plan, begun on September 11th, inaugurated a stage that Hussein calls the Awakening. The ideologues within al-Qaeda believed that the Islamic nation was in a state of hibernation because of repeated catastrophes inflicted upon Muslims by the West. By striking America, the head of the serpent, al-Qaeda caused the United States to lose consciousness and act chaotically against those who attacked it. This entitled the party that hit the serpent to lead the Islamic nation. This first stage, says Hussein, ended in 2003 when American troops entered Baghdad. The second stage, eye-opening, would last until the end of 2006, Hussein writes. Iraq would become the recruiting ground for young men eager to attack America. The electronic jihad on the internet would propagate al-Qaeda's ideas, and Muslims would be pressed to donate funds to make up for the seizure of terrorist assets by the West. The third stage, a rising and standing up, would last from 2007 to 2010. Al-Qaeda's focus would be on Syria and Turkey, but it would also begin to directly confront Israel in order to gain more credibility among the Muslim population. In the fourth stage, lasting until 2013, al-Qaeda would bring about the demise of Arab governments. The creeping loss of the regime's power will lead to a steady growth in strength within al-Qaeda, Hussein predicts. Meanwhile, attacks against the Middle East petroleum industry would continue, and America's power would deteriorate through the constant expansion of the circle of confrontation. By then, al-Qaeda will have completed its electronic capabilities, and it will be time to use them to launch electronic attacks to undermine the U.S. economy. Then an Islamic caliphate can be declared. The fifth stage of al-Qaeda's grand plan. At this stage, the Western fist in the Arab region will loosen, and Israel will not be able to carry out preemptive or precautionary strikes, Hussein writes. The international balance will change. Al-Qaeda and the Islamist movement will attract powerful new economic allies, such as China, and the European Union will fall into disarray. The sixth phase will be a period of total confrontation, he predicts. The now established caliphate will form an Islamic army and will instigate a worldwide fight between the believers and the non-believers. Hussein proclaims, the world will realize the meaning of real terrorism. By 2020, definitive victory will have been achieved. Victory, according to the al-Qaeda ideologues, means that falsehood will come to an end. The Islamic State will lead the human race once again to the shore of safety and the oasis of happiness.